Let me restart this. Moose Turd Cafe. Here it is, March the something. not quite the Ides yet. You know, we're at March the 5th. Okay. Now, as I was saying, for the next 3 days, we're kind of having a dead fest. Dead and friends. I mean, it's going to include friends. Plus, we're going to be on the literature side and the talk side. We're going to be doing some Bob Dylan book reports. The actual books, however, in his Nobel lecture, he mentioned All Quiet on the Western Front, Moby Dick, and The Odyssey as his three books that most influenced him. Maybe I'm putting words in his mouth, but anyway, it's the three he chose most to talk about. in any event, it's a brilliant, I think his lecture is one of the best things he's ever done. And it's an insight to how he thinks and to the books he talks about as well, and why, you know, Bob Dylan himself has become an American myth in many ways, and at least for those interested in this side of the myth. So it puts a very American twist on you know, three classic tales, only one of which was written by an American. So that's going to be our literature framework for the next 2 days. Then starting on March 8th, International Women's Day, it's going to be a women's month, man. I mean, that's what it's going to be for the rest of March. We're going to be hearing the history of women jazz singers, for example, called the divas. Okay, I just got wonderful libraries of their stuff. In addition to literature and some storytelling, we're continuing today with a story we're in the midst of here, which is The Riddle Master of Head, and we're going to do a little bit of that each day. I'll give you a little heads up as to where we are in that tale when we get to it, but. Anyway, so that's going to be the program this morning. We're going to hear from the gunslinger and some other important topics on the economics front. We're going to be talking about the, digging in a little bit with the help of Jared Bernstein to the tariffs that the President Dickhead has announced. And we'll see where we go from there. But we're going to start out this morning with a friend of the devil and... it sort of fits the time here. And having done that, I got to turn on all my clicks here. Otherwise, nothing works. And we do that. And we turn on the this part here. No, this one. There we go. This is from a 1970 concert. At something called the Capitol Arena. I don't know where it is. It might be in D.C. Anyway.
Lighten up.
Yeah, that guy in the audience, shut him up, okay? Come on.
Sit down, mother, take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I can she's my heart's blood. Second one is a prison babe, and the sheriff's on my trail. And if he catches up with me, I'll spend my life in jail. First one say she got my child, but it don't look like me. Said I'll run, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight.
Yeah, friend of the devil. That's us. And here on Enlightened Radio .org. So we're going to be doing as I mentioned, a dead fest. I got concerts from just everywhere. Anyway, and a great library as well. Okay, so we're going to be exploiting it all here on the in a dead fest. All week here, well, most of the week, until the 8th. That's about, well, that's three days. Anyway, it's just like, it's going to be beautiful until the 8th. And then it's going to be women. We're going to listen to the voices of women, okay? That's what's going to happen, you know, during the month of March, or from March 8th, International Women's Day, and onward. But in the meantime, we're going to start up this morning here with, of course, we now live in the land of gun nuts. Everyone's going to be armed, and so it's a time to reflect upon how, you know, the gunslingers have stepped up here, and who the true gunslingers really are. We're going to find that out, since everybody's walking around pretending they're one. We're going to find out about the actual gunslinger, okay? And, you know, what is decided by the gunslinger and what is not? Last time we had an introduction to this, the mythic gunslinger, the meta gunslinger, okay? And it's narrated by a guy that gets to meet the gunslinger. I met in Messiah, the cautious gunslinger of impeccable personal smoothness and slender leather-encased hands. Folded casually to make his knock. He would show you his map and say, there is your domain. Is it the domicile it looks to be, or simply a retinal block of seats? He will flip the phrase, the theater of impatience. Anyway, we meet the gunslinger in part one. And have a couple conversations with him, and we find out he has to pee a couple times, but he wants to have a drink with our friend he's just met. And we left him with the fact that the gunslinger was hunting for Hughes Howard, and that, you know, the question had arisen, but what would you have... When you have found him, my gunslinger, what will you do? Oh, what will you do? You do not know the souls of old Texans. that are in jeopardy in a way not common to other men. That was the gunslinger's message, okay? You would not know of the long plains night where they carry on and arrange their genetic duels with men of other states. So there is a longhorn bull, half mad, half god, who awaits an account from me. Back of the sun, you nearly disturbed, sir. So now we're going to have the gunslinger returns after, you know, a pee on the cactus here. Swum! We hear the guitar. I should bring the guitar over here. Okay. And by that sound, we had come there. False fronts, my gunslinger said, make the people mortal and give their business an inward cast. They cause culture. Honk, 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 honk. That sound comes at the end of the dusty street. Where do we meet? The gaudy madam of that very cabaret, going in where our drink is to be drunk. Well, hello there, slinger. Long time no see. What brings you and who's your friend to these parts? And where, if you don't mind my asking, hello, are you headed? Boston? You don't say. Boston. Boston is an actionable town, they say. Never been there myself, but I've had some nice girls from up Boston way. Turned out real spunky, they did. But you look like you always did, slinger. You still make me shake. I mean, why do you think I got my hands on my hip if not to steady myself? And the way I twirl this Kansas City parasol, if not to keep the dazzle of them spurs out of my eyes. Miss Lil, I intervened. You mustn't slap my gunslinger on the back in such an offhand manner. Well, I think the sun, the moon, and some of the stars are kept in their tracks by this person's equilibrium. Or at least I sense some effect on the perigee and apogee of all our movements in this. I can't quite say man's presence, the setting sun's attention I would allude to, and the very appearance of his neurasthenic mare, lathered, as you can see, with abstract fatigue. Shit, slinger, you still got that bitchy old nag? And who is the funny talker? You pick him up in some sludgy scat of higher learning? Creeps. You always did hang out with some curious refugees. Anyway, come up and see me. Bring your friend anytime. If you're going to be in town, we got an awful lot to talk about. For instance, remember that man you is always looking for? Name of Hughes? Howard? I asked. You got it. That was the gent's first handle. A Texas dynaminer he was back in 32. Always turned my girls on a lot when he blew in. A man in the house is worth two in the street any day. Like I say, this Hughes, Howard, had a kind of interest about him. Namely, he had a saddlebag full of currency, which don't hurt none. You remember there was this little trick. Called her Jane. Well, you was sweet on her. Got religion later. Dropped out. But I heard this Hughes. Howard? I asked. Right, boy. They say he moved to Vegas. Or bought Vegas and moved in. I can't remember which. Anyway, I remember you had what your friend here might call an obsession about the man. Don't tell me you're still looking for it. I mean, they say, I can't prove it by me. Hughes, Howard, I asked. Hey, slinger, you better shut that boy up. Cut it, my friend. I was just, drop it. Anyway, they say this Howard is kind of peculiar about being seen like anywhere, anytime. sort of a spooky type, like a lot of Texans. I know, plumb strange the way they operate. You know, I had a deal with a Texan once and nearly drove one of my best girls insane. Insisted on her playing blackjack with his stud horse, who was pretty good. Held the cards with his hooves, real articulate-like, and could add faster than most humans. Recall before I put a stop to it, we had a special furniture brought in from Topeka. That horse would sit at the table all night. Terrible on whiskey and rolled a fair smoke. And this Texan insisted he was paying for my girl's time and he could use it any way he saw fit as long as he was paying. And like I had to explain, a technical point to that shareholder, namely, that he was paying for her ass, which is not time. How did you get rid of him? I asked. Well, boy, that was singular. You know, I thought and thought, and then I was plumb stumped. That is, to one of my regulars of the time who had an interest in this girl. I can't recall her name. But you'd know the fella, a wrangler from Wyoming. The Word, his name was anyway. Well, The Word, that was his name. Anyway, he suggested that he turn that horse on. Hughes, I asked. Jesus, Slinger, can't you do something about that refugee? Now, his mother was religious, so we turned this stud on, and it took most of a Tampico shipment to do the job. But I'll tell you, Slinger, that horse laughed all night, and they carried him out the next morning and put him on a stage for Amarillo. Him and the Texan sitting in there all alone. And that horse was telling everybody what to do. Get that strong books up there. Get them horses hitched up, he'd say, rolling a big Tampico bomber with his hooves and his shoes had come off, you see, so he could do it sort of natural. And then he'd kind of lounge inside the stagecoach and lean out the window, winking at all the girls, showing his teeth. I can't say he was unattractive. Something kind of handsome about that big face and suggestive he was. He had a sort of manner. He kept saying, can you manage? And thank you. Every time the hostler hitched up another horse. And then he had that kind of, what you might call a derisive air when he'd say, due in on Monday. Because you see, it was Sunday. But they left him. He kept knocking his right hoof against the inside of the coach, saying, y'all right out there? And he had a Texan's hat on, a Stetson double X, sort of cockwise on his head. It was, I tell you, Slinger, you would have split your Levi's and dropped your beads just to seen it. Because he was saying some of the abstractest things you ever heard of, like, celery is crisp. And we ain't seen him or that individual Texan who owned him since. I swear that stud must have become a congressman or something since then. He was sure going strong on that fresh Tampico. Some of the hands that were there that day, in fact, claimed he didn't leave on the stage at all. There's still people around who claim that horse flew back west when the Texan went to sleep 5 miles out of town. Where were we? I asked when I noticed my gunslinger had retired to a shady spot cast by the town's one cottonwood tree. The only shade within 50 miles. Hold on, requested the gunslinger and held a conference to the side with Lil. And then he kissed her with a smile, her hand, and said, hey, she said, you boys enjoy yourself. I'll see you later. And then as we mounted the steps of the cabaret, the gunslinger started singing. Oh, a girl there was in the street the day we rode into La Cruz. And the name of her feet was the same as the name of the street. And she stood And she stared like a moose. And her hair was all tangled and loose. Strum! And there we have our little interlude with the gunslinger. Right? Y'all bearing arms today? Well, watch out for that horse. Celery is crisp. Well, we're going to listen to a little thing here coming from the way back from the Allman Brothers. Ain't wasting time no more. And welcome back here to the the Moose Turd Cafe, and a confection inspired by Utah Phillips, the great IWW folk singer. Anyway, he worked out on time for the Santa Fe Railroad, and everybody had to take turns being the cook, but he didn't want to be a cook, so he tried to, in order to stop being a cook, he had to get somebody to complain about the meal, and he cooked up a moose turd pie for everybody. But turned out that had been done before. So his plan didn't work. Anyway, it's, you know, we had a time here where we were basically, you know, I think swallowing Trump is just like first, frankly, you know, and then maybe it wouldn't taste so bad. that was kind of, that was the other inspiration. But in the meantime, we're going to hope you enjoyed the little excerpt from The Gunslinger. The Gunslinger myth is an interesting one. Yeah, very, very prominent in, you know, Western American culture. Think of all the movies in which there's a gunslinger, you know, the gunman, you know. Sometimes it's the lawman, you know. That would be the more civilized, I suppose, metaphor. Well, there's an authority, it's actually a legal authority in town. You know, everybody agreed to hire this guy rather than, you know, nobody hired him. He just took your money and ran, kind of thing. But both, he could be either one. A gunslinger could be on both sides of the law. And a matter of fact, they are, aren't they? Yeah, that's right. It seems to be a time of the gunslinger that we've entered. And we'll find, of course, he's chasing, the gunslinger is chasing the ineffable Howard Hughes. Still hiding out in some hotel. all right, we're going to move on here, though, however, to the economic report of the day. And that concerns the recent and highly publicized steel tariffs, steel and metals, aluminum tariffs on imported steel and aluminum on the grounds that other countries are dumping, in other words, selling at under cost into the United States market their surplus steel. And undercutting fair prices and thereby putting American steel manufacturers either out of business or compelled to go over and get their own little colony land they can use to, you know, get cheap labor from. So that's the so Trump is doing, trying to, is pretending to fulfill his America First promise. And so I'm going to read a little bit, you know, well, I'm going to excerpt, summarize in some cases. Jared Bernstein's discussion of this, because I think it's it hits the mark. And, you know, when you're talking about the economic effects of things, you got to remember effects. You know, you always got to ask the question, or your best advice to ask the question, economics for who? Okay, because people can have very different groups of people in mind when they propound that something is good or something is bad or, you know, or something is coming from left field or something is not. Anyway, so in Washington, D.C., we're only 70 miles out of D.C. here in Harper's Ferry, Bolivar, West Virginia. But we get a lot of train riders, including in my family, back and forth to the city all the time. So I hear that even the everybody, the howling wind is angry about President Trump's new tariffs on steel, which are about the 25%, and aluminum imports as well, which are being going to be hit with a 10% tax. Now, normally, you know, trade, you know, things have to go through a process of congressional review, and they have to be vetted by the trade representatives, and because trade is a very complex thing. Everybody's trading with everybody, and you know, you can have many unintended side effects from just flipping one lever and thinking that's all you're doing. Nonetheless, we have a president that appears to be more or less owned by the primary energy and natural resources industries, okay, of which steel and metals, of course, are the immediate output. If you're a miner selling coal, other than for heat, which is getting cut, the coal that's getting cut out of the coal, then the other place you sell it is to make steel. Same thing with, you know, other energy resource, aluminum, metals. And Trump has been quoted as saying, you don't have a steel industry, you don't have a country. You know, he says stupid shit all the time, but whatever. but nonetheless, almost every analysis that's out there has been warning of price increases, a trade war. Canada announced it will retaliate. China has been kind of coy about what it's going to do to retaliate, but many European countries are threatening retaliation as well. It's you know, so we're the possibility of what is a trade war? Well, I'm going to tax your stuff. Well, I'm going to tax yours. So the tendency would be is for overall trade to slow down, okay, and therefore there to be a net wealth reduction. Plus, as it slowed down, prices would rise as firms, you know, tried to survive the slowdown in growth and in sales. So here we go. Let's get into it a little bit. The problem is that you know, even though that all these things might happen, falling stock prices, you understand that Carl Icahn sold all of his steel talk stocks when he heard about it. trade wars, which can lead to real world wars. Okay, people get really angry at being denied. What happens if it's vital stuff like gasoline and energy, and you raise the price of that? That's the cost of everything. That's why these natural resource and industries and corporations are so powerful and have so much leverage, and how they probably shouldn't have any of that leverage and it should be taken away from them. But that awaits the revolution, I suppose, in any event. And there's no question that the tariffs are a very crude a tool that can have many unintended effects. However, you know, it seems weird that we're now a year after Trump's upset victory, after Brexit took over England. And by the way, yesterday I understand the right wing has taken over the largest vote turnout anyway in Italy. You have fascist movements in the United States behind the Trump that are very closely allied to the Trump. Stephen Miller, the KKK outfits, the white supremacists, of which we find out there's quite a few. The freaking murderers out there, okay, they're all aligned with Trump. Okay, so we have this is happening worldwide, and perhaps we're not yet getting the message of this rise of right wing populism. You know, a nostalgic for a bygone era and an industrial mix of political and social classes. You know, workers who could were a working class, but they could through, as it turns out, unions, not just that's how they got more income. But anyway, we still have this situation where it appears that economic elites are refusing to acknowledge and deal with the fact that there are many that are hurt by trade and globalization. Is it most people? Well, I mean, that's arguable, okay? But there are whole communities where certainly most people are wiped out. And this wipeout, it took place in the Rust Belt of the United States, you know, as the deindustrialization took place, as runaway jobs, as the so-called middle class jobs for wage workers, which means high paying wage jobs, okay, could rise to median income and buy a home, maybe on loans, get their kids to college, or, you know, I mean, someone could live better in this life and the one that following me and my kids than I could. And that's a very inspirational thing, and many families were motivated in that direction. But it got wiped out. And trade is, you know, not even the biggest part of it. Automation is a big part of it, but it's a part of it. The relocation of, it's weird how people are, let's buy American steel companies when it's a steel company that did one of the biggest exporters of capital. You hire American, but don't invest in America. That kind of thing. You ended up in that kind of crappy thing. And for the workers in those industries, I mean, they're sucker bait now for, you know, a come along of a jackass like Trump and tell you he's going to do something for you. Yeah. And of course, you know, you end up getting shoved up your behind anyway. But nonetheless, if you were not seeing that the political fallout on this ultra-right thing is part of not paying attention to what's happening with trade and to the distribution of wealth that happens with this global trading system, or rather distribution of wealth. But, you know, and also, for example, the people who are most worried about the tariffs, you know, fall back on, you know, these elementary rationales for free trade, which, let's think about that for a minute. You know, trade does creates winners and losers, but the benefits to the winners are large enough to more than offset the losses to the losers. That's the theory, okay? Because there'll be more, yeah, you might lose your job, but you'll get another job in another sector making as much or more. You know, that's the theory, okay? And that's the line that is used. That's the free trade line. And American economic and social policy, even after all that has transpired, still gets the first part right. More trade. We do get more trade with less rules, okay? But not only do the winners fail to compensate those hurt by trade, they use their winnings to buy politicians and policies that consolidate their gains while further penalizing those left behind. That's from Jared Bernstein. And I think he's right about that. I mean, we have to pay attention. It's like the conversation I've had with some liberals, you know, where we'll go along the list of, well, we need, you know, to get rid of discrimination, and we need to raise up the bars on race and on gender. And, I mean, we need to improve, you know, those inequalities. But when you get right down to the question of, well, how about raising their wages? And you'll get a nod of the head from the sort of corporate liberals and the sort of liberals and the people who are, you know, either own little businesses or have professional incomes or, you know, you'll get a little thing from them on that. But it's not it doesn't get to the top of their list. And so when they get elected, you know, it's but. We don't have time to take care of that. You know, all those steelworkers that lost their jobs. And now, you know, their families are wrecked, you know, many of them. You know, they're looking for answers. What did I do wrong? Did I do anything wrong? And why didn't I see this coming? Why did it happen to me? And along comes a Trumper with, you know, Trump or some creep, you know, with, you know, the answer. Well, it's the black people. It's the government. They're taking your money, and that, you know, it's Cletus and, you know, the other, you know, idiots start mouthing all this stuff, and you start to believe part of it, because, you know, the one thing you can't argue with is that you got screwed. One of the problems is that you know, the tariffs that are that Trump has announced, the minute you do it, even on something very, you know, like some, like low level grade of rubber tires or something like that, all the cheering squads for globalization and free trade start shouting, trade war. Problem is, they have overplayed this hand because such narrow tariffs are extremely common and countries engage in them all the time while continuing to engage in robust trade across the board. But the Trump tariffs are not narrowly targeted. That's a problem. They apply to Chinese steel, which is legitimate in the sense that it is often underpriced, as well as steel from everywhere else. And China is not even on the top 10 of the countries from whom we import steel. I mean, it is the top for aluminum, okay? But most of our steel imports come from Canada, Brazil, Mexico, and South Korea, China accounts for about 2%. That's all. So when close allies such as Canada talk about retaliation, which they're doing, Justin Trudeau did, they may well mean it this time. I'm much less worried about China, although I expect countervailing tariffs from them, probably on some of our agricultural exports. That's good in a way. If you're into pea, you know, that'll hit some of the right-wing Republican states. Trump, have you paid attention to who you're screwing here? Some of your buddies going to get nailed. Of course, what Trump says he's going to do and what he really does, we'll see what really happens. Anyway, because of the way that Trump's launching it, though, a widespread retaliation does seem like more of a possibility this time than sometimes. The tariffs might pump up domestic steel and aluminum production. There is a significant unused capacity in both sectors in the United States. But their net impact on the economy, depending on how long they remain in place, could range from slightly negative to worse than that. Okay? But that's a partial and incomplete analysis. I'm going with Jared Bernstein again here. What matters here is not just economy, but political economy. Readers of my column, this is Jared talking, know I've had almost nothing good to say about this particular president's economic policy as he betrays his working class constituents at almost every turn, no matter what he says. But there should be no question that he masterfully tuned into their anxiety and its linkages to globalization in a way that blew the lid off the denial of the fundamental flaw in U.S.-style globalization's winners are winning, but the losers are not being compensated and turned into winners. Something that was well understood by the left, by even the elites in the left-wing side or the center side, like the Robert Rubens and the people like that, okay? I mean, they see that as wrong. But the problem is that there's no coherent policy agenda that's been articulated to help connect those who've been left behind. Trump's a bunch of lies, okay? But he's appealing to it. So that's the problem is that how do we get the gains from globalization distributed, to the public? And as part of the reinvestment, if you have a net gain in one sector of the economy as a result of trade, to let the devastated part of your country just go to hell or work at McDonald's, it's not going to end well. I like that phrase. I heard it from my wife and I heard it. Some military guy, was trying to be discreet and not say anything. He kept being asked about Trump, and he says, it's not going to end well. Anyway, so that's our economic report today. The steel tariffs are probably going to cause a lot of harm, especially if they've applied to the wrong people, And I'm sure the Chinese will figure out a way to dodge the bullet, big time. They're brilliant at that recently, and they're outsmarting Trump at every turn. And plus, now we have Xi Jinping in for life. I'm not quite sure what the justification for that is, but another country, another culture. I guess it doesn't pay to impose your own prejudices on. So we're going to take a little break here and return to the powerful music. Who are we going to play this time? We're going to do a little bit of Dixie Chicken. Here we go. I think that's about right speed.
Oh, she took me to the river. spells on the money I put down on the white picket fence and the rock of the house at the edge of town. Call my name. If you'll be my Dixie chicken, I'll be your Tennessee lamb. We can walk together down in Dixie land, down in Dixie land.
And welcome back here to the Moose Turd Cafe here, broadcast on enlightenedradio.org. My name is John Case, and we're continuing on here with a couple of items. Let me see what's on my... it's always good for me to check my... we need to... the strike is still on, as far as and there's been no notice of any change, other than we're still waiting for the Senate to, stop whatever perverted masturbating they're doing in public. This would be the West Virginia Senate, especially its leader, Mitch McConnell. I mean, this man is embarrassing himself and, everyone else as to what is he doing there? He can't seem to... he's being clobbered and really isolated, but he refuses to vote on the deal that both the House and the governor have approved, with a 5% raise for the teachers and 3% for all state employees. And, as a settlement of the current dispute and decided doing something about not, they haven't had a raise in 13 years. And they're fooling with it. They're just sitting on their thumbs over there. So anyway, we're trying to get him off the dime, and whatever it takes to do that, I don't know. Got to be done. It has to be done. So we're going to see what happens this week. Hopefully it's going to get resolved soon. I know the kids dying to go to school. Otherwise, I got to stay with mom all day, who probably gets tired of letting them watch TV. or they get agitated after watching TV anyway. Probably don't behave that well after the, depending on the program, no doubt. But anyway, so that's what's, that's, the teachers are on, and so you've joined the picket lines. I think they're still having them at Shepherdstown, at the library, at the Ranson, at the Panera's, and on in Charlestown, at the Charlestown Library. So that's Jefferson County. I don't have the details on Berkeley County. We're trying to get somebody in here to, tomorrow morning here to talk a little bit about the experiences on the picket line of the strike. The teachers are leading the way and returning sanity to West Virginia here. They're trying to. All right, we're going to, I think what I'm going to do is, I had a couple of poems I was going to do more, but I think I'm going to close with the this latest excerpt, our next installment in The Riddle Master of Head. And I'm going to do it because, why am I doing it? Well, one, I love the story. It just adds something to my day to think about it. Well, last, a brief summary, we were introduced to the Prince of Head. You'll find out more about what Head is. It's an island on another version of our world from either way in the future or in the past. I guess that's the question someone will have to determine. Mostly in the past, we'll say. And so it's a magical kingdom in a way. It's an earth. It's an earth-like kingdom, but driven by Patricia McKillop's very, quite visionary forces of nature. And what that nature might be is part of the question of the story. And she asks it. She beautifully asks it beautifully. We're introduced to the Prince of Head, Morgan, and his brother and sister. It turns out that Morgan has gotten drunk, and then gets into an altercation and a fist fight with his brother, because his brother is mad at him. And why is his brother mad at him? Well, his brother's mad at him because he found out that Morgan, who has been attending a scholar's school, in which the highest form of learning is called the mastery of riddles. And as a outstanding student in this field, Morgan, and as a prince as well, Morgan decided to engage in a riddle master game with the ghost of the king of Alm, one of the larger countries on this world. And he won the bet, the first time anyone in thousands of years has won one with the ghost of the king. And as a result, he gets to take the king's crown home, studded with jewels and artwork of another age. And he didn't know what to do with it. And so he put it under his bed, but his brother found it and suspected that there was something terrible, something important, something portentous that had taken place. So he asked Morgan, so what would have happened if you had lost the game? And his brother says, well, I had to win it. Now, it turns out that if a prince of a land dies, a spiritual aspect of the land's identity, fruitfulness, character, stability, weather, all kinds of things, are put at great risk, okay? And therefore, Morgan's brother had rightfully concerned about the fate of his land should the land heir, which is what they called the prince, should he be killed or lost. And so we basically pick up the story at that point, and here we go. We gotta do the Riddle Master of Head. Here we go.
My brains are made of oak.
Here we go.
If you pump for me, I'll pump for you. They stripped and washed behind the house.
This is Morgan and his brother.
To Grim Oakland's farm to help load the grain and his storage barn onto carts. And Morgan walked through the stubbled fields to the shore road that led to Toll. The three trade ships, their sails furled, had just docked. A ramp boomed down from one of them as Morgan stepped onto the wharf. He watched a horse being led down by a sailor, a beautiful long-legged mare bred in Arn, jet black with a bridle that flashed minute flecks of jewels in the sun. Then traders hailed him from the prow of a ship, and he went to meet them as they disembarked. They were a vivid group, some dressed in the long, thin orange and red coats from Harun, others in full robes from Arn, or the close-fitting, lavishly embroidered tunics from Imris. They wore rings and chains from Ezik, fur-lined caps from Osterland, which they gave away, together with bone-handled knives and copper brooches, to the children clustering shyly to watch. The ships carried, among other things, iron from Ezik and Harun wine. Grim Oakland came a few minutes later, as Morgan was inspecting the wine.
"I need a drink, too, after that," he commented.
Morgan started to smile and changed his mind.
"Is the grain loaded?" "Nearly. Harlstone is bringing the wool and skins down from your barn. You'd be wise to take all the metal they carry."
Morgan nodded, his eyes straying again to the black horse tethered to the dock rail. A sailor lugged a saddle down from the ship, balanced it on the rail next to the horse. Morgan gestured with his cup.
"Who owns that mare? It looks like someone came with the traders, or else Eliard traded Akron for her secretly." "I don't know," Grim said, his red-grey brows peaked. "Lad, it's none of my business, but you shouldn't let your private inclinations interfere with the duty you were born to."
Morgan sipped wine.
"They don't interfere. It would be a grave interference if you were dead."
He shrugged. "There's Eliard." Grim heaved a sigh.
"I told your father not to send you to that school. It's addled your thinking. But no, he wouldn't listen. I told him it was wrong to let you go away from head so long. It's never been done. No good would come of it. And I was right. No good has come. You running off to a strange land, playing riddle games with a man who should have the decency to stay put once he's dead and buried in the earth. It's not good. It's not the way a land ruler of head should want to behave. It's not done."
Morgan held the cool metal of the cup against his cracked mouth. "Pevin couldn't help wandering around after he was dead. He killed 7 of his sons with misused wizardry, and then himself out of sorrow and shame. He couldn't rest in the ground. He told me that after so many years, he had a hard time remembering all his sons' names. That worried him. I learned their names at Caithnard, so I could tell him. It cheered him up." Grim's face was red as a turkey wattle.
"It's indecent," he snapped.
He moved away, lifted the lid on a chest full of bars of iron, and slammed it shut again. A trader spoke at Morgan's elbow.
"You are pleased with the wine, Lord?"
Morgan turned, nodding. The trader ported a thin leaf-green coat from Harun, a cap of white mink, and a harp of black wood slung by a strap of white leather over one shoulder. Morgan said,
"Whose horse? Where did you get that harp?"
The trader grinned, sliding it from his shoulder.
"Remembering how your lordship likes harps, I found this one for you in Arn. It was the harp of the harpist of Lord Coll of Hell. It's quite old, but see how beautifully preserved."
Morgan slid his hands down the fine carved pieces. He brushed the strings with his fingers, then plucked one softly.
"What would I do with all those strings?" he murmured. "There must be over 30. Do you like it? Keep it with you a while. Play it."
"I can't possibly." The trader silenced him with a flick of hand.
"How can you set a value to such a harp? Take it. Become acquainted with it. There is no need to make a decision now."
He slipped the strap over Morgan's head.
"If you like it, no doubt we can come to a satisfactory arrangement."
"No doubt." He caught Grim Oakland's eye and blushed. He carried the harp with him to the trade hall at Toll, where the traders inspected his beer, grain and wool, ate cheese and fruit, and bartered for an hour with him, while Grim Oakland stood watchfully at his elbow. Empty carts were brought to the dock then to load metal, casks of wine and blocks of salt from the beds above Caithnard. Plough horses to be taken to Harun and Arn were penned near the dock for loading. The traders began to tally the grain sacks and kegs of beer. Wyndon Emery's carts lumbered down the coast road unexpectedly near noon. Cannon Master, riding in the back of one, leapt down and said to Morgan, "Wyndon sent them out yesterday. One of them lost a wheel, so the drivers fixed it in Silwold's farm and stayed the night. I met them coming. Did they talk you into the harp?" "Almost. Listen to it." "Morgan, you know I'm as musical as a tin bucket. Your mouth looks like a squash plum." "Don't make me laugh," Morgan pleaded. "Will you and Elliard take the traders to Akron? They're about finished here." "What are you going to do?" "Buy a horse and a pair of shoes." Cannon's brows rose. "And a harp?" "Maybe." "Yes," he chuckled. "Good. I'll take Elliard away for you." Morgan wandered down into the belly of a ship, where half a dozen horses from Arn were stabled for the journey. He started them while men stacked sacks of grain beyond him in the shadowy hold. A trader found him there. They talked a while, Morgan running his fingers down the sleek neck of a stallion the colour of polished wood. He emerged finally, drawing deep breaths of clean air. Most of the carts were gone. The sailors were drifting towards the trade hall to eat. The sea nuzzled the ships, swirled white around the massive trunks of pine supporting the docks. He went to the end of the pier and sat down. In the distance, the fishing boats from Toll rose and dipped like ducks in the water. Far beyond them, a dark thread along the horizon, lay the vast, sprawling mainland, the realm of the High One. He set the harp on one knee and played a harvest song whose brisk, even rhythm kept time to the sweep of a scythe. A fragment of an Imrys ballad teased his memory. He was picking it out haltingly from the strings when a shadow fell over his hands. He looked up. A man he had never seen before, neither trader nor sailor, stood beside him. He was quietly dressed, the fine cloth and colour of his blue-black tunic, the heavy chain of linked stamped squares of silver on his breast were bewildering. His face was lean, fine-boned, neither young nor old. His hair was a loose cap of silver. "Morgan of Head?" "Yes. I am Death, the High One's harpist." Morgan swallowed. He shifted to rise, but the harpist forestalled him, squatting down to look at the harp. "Euon," he said, showing Morgan a name half hidden in a whirl of design. "He was a harp maker in Hell 3 centuries ago. There are only 5 of his harps in existence." "The trader said it belonged to the harpist of Lord Coll." "Did you come? Well, you must have come with them. Is that your horse? Why didn't you tell me before that you were here?"
"You were busy. I preferred to wait. The High One instructed me last spring to come to Head to express his sorrow over the deaths of Artol and Spring. But I was trapped in Isig by a stubborn winter, delayed in Imrys by a siege of Caer Wedyn, and requested, just as I was about to embark for Caithnard, in an urgent message from Maetham of Arn to get to Anuin. I'm sorry to have come so late."
"I remember your name," Morgan said slowly. "My father used to say Death played at his wedding." He stopped, listening to his words. A shudder wilted out of him unexpectedly. "I'm sorry. He thought it was funny. He loved your harping. I would like to hear you play." The harpist settled himself on the pier and picked up Euon's harp.
"What would you like to hear?"
Morgan felt his mouth pulled awry in spite of himself by a smile. "Play, let me think. Would you play what I was trying to play? The Lament for Bellew and Below?" Death tuned a string softly and began the ancient ballad. "Bellew so fair was born with the dark Below, the dark. Death bound them also. Mourn, Bellew, fine ladies, mourn, Below." His fingers drew the tail faultlessly from the flashing close-set strings. Morgan listened motionlessly, his eyes on the smooth, detached face. The skilled hands, the fine voice worn to precision, traced the path of Below, helpless in its turbulence. The death he left in his wake, the death that trailed him, that rode behind Bellew on his horse, ran at his horse's side like a hound. Bellew so fair followed the dark Below. Death followed them so. Death cried to Belo out of Bellew's voice, to Bellew out of Belo. The long surfeited sigh of the tide broke the silence of their deaths. Morgan stirred. He put his hand on the dark, carved face of the harp. If I could make that sound come out of that harp, I would sell my name for it and go nameless. Death smiled. That's too high a price to pay even for one of Yuan's harps. What are the traders asking for it? He shrugged. They'll take what I'm offering for it. You want it that badly? Morgan looked at him. I would sell my name for it, but not the grain my farmers have scorched their backs harvesting, or the horses they have raised and gentled. What I will offer belongs only to me. There's no need to justify yourself to me, the harpist said mildly. Morgan's mouth crooked. He touched it absently. I'm sorry. I spent half the morning justifying myself. For what? His eyes dropped to the rough iron-bound planks of the pier. He answered the quiet, skilled stranger impulsively. Do you know how my parents died? Yes. My mother wanted to see Caithnard. My father had come two or three times to visit me while I was at the College of Riddle Masters at Caithnard. That sounds simple, but it was a very courageous thing for him to do. Leave Head, go to a great strange city. The princes of Head are rooted to Head. When I came home a year ago, after spending 3 years there, I found my father full of stories about what he had seen, the trade shops, the people from different lands. And when he mentioned a shop with bolts of cloth and furs and dyes from 5 kingdoms, my mother couldn't resist going. She loved the feel and colours of fine cloth. So last spring, they sailed over with the traders when the spring trading was done. And they never came back. The return ship was lost. They never came back. He touched a nail head, traced a circle around it. There was something I had been wanting to do for a long time. I did it then. My brother Eliard found out about it this morning. I didn't tell him at the time because I knew he would be upset. I just told him that I was going to West Head for a few days, not that I was going across the sea to Arn. To Arn? Why did you... He stopped. His voice went suddenly thin as a lathe. Morgan of Head, did you win Pevin's crown? Morgan's head rose sharply. He said after a moment, Yes. How... Yes. You didn't tell the King of Arn. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't want to talk about it. Orber of Orm, one of the descendants of Pevin, went to that tower to try to win back the crown of Orm from the dead lord, and found the crown gone, and Pevin pleading to be set free to leave the tower. Orber demanded in vain the name of the man who had taken the crown. Pevin said only that he would answer no more riddles. Orber told Maetham, and Maetham, faced with the news that someone had slipped quietly into his land, won a riddle game men have lost their lives over for centuries, and left as quietly. Summon me from Caithnard and ask me to find that crown. Head is the last place I expected it to be. It's been under my bed, Morgan said blankly. The only private place in Arkhan. I don't understand. Does Maetham want it back? I don't need it. I haven't even looked at it since I brought it home. But I thought Maetham of all people would understand. The crown is yours by right. Maetham will be the last to contest that. He paused. There was an expression in his eyes that puzzled Morgan. He added gently, And yours, if you choose, is Maetham's daughter, Raedurl. Morgan swallowed. He found himself on his feet, looking down at the harpist, and knelt down, seeing suddenly, instead of the harpist, a pale, high-boned face full of unexpected expressions, shaking itself free of a long, fine mass of red hair. He whispered, Raedurl, I know her. Maetham's son, Rude, was at the college with me. We were good friends. She used to visit him there. I don't understand. The king made a vow at her birth to give her only to the man who took the crown of Orm from Pevin. He made a... What a stupid thing for him to do, promising Raedurl to any man with enough brains to outwit Pevin.
He could have been anyone.
He stopped, the blood receding a little beneath his tan.
It was me.
Yes.
But I can't. She can't marry a farmer. Maytham will never consent.
Maytham follows his own inclinations. I suggest you ask him.
Morgan gazed at him. You mean cross the sea to Annwn, to the king's court, walk into his great hall in cold blood and ask him?
You walked into Pevin's tower.
Well, that was different. I didn't have lords from the three portions of Arn watching me then.
Morgan, Maytham bound himself to his vow with his own name, and the lords of Arn, who have lost ancestors, brothers, even sons in that tower, will give you nothing less than honour for your courage and wit. The only question you have to consider at this moment is, do you want to marry Redurl?
He stood up again, desperate with uncertainty, ran his hands through his hair, and the wind, roused from the sea, whipped it straight back from his face.
Redurl!
A pattern of stars high above one brow flamed vividly against his skin. He saw her face again at a distance, turn back to look at him.
Redurl!
He saw the harpist's face go suddenly still, as if the wind had snatched in passing its expression and breath. The uncertainty ended in him like a song's ending.
Yes. Chapter 2.
He sat on a keg of beer on the deck of a trade ship the next morning.
Well, that's a good place to pause our story here for the day in the Moose Turd Cafe, and we'll be back tomorrow with another mixed-up thing of some sort. I'll let you know later what it is. This is John Case, and thank you for tuning in to Enlightened Radio. We're going to return to the finish of Sleepy Hollow, and then we're going to be moving on to something very profound. Yeah. All right. Take care, man. Bye-bye.